the Professional Education Group, is pleased to present Negotiation and Settlement in the 90s, New Dimensions for Lawyers. This program was recorded in front of a live seminar audience and is accompanied by a manual which complements the course content. The program features Gerald R. Williams, a highly acclaimed CLE lecturer and consultant on the subject of legal negotiations. He is professor of law at Brigham Young University. Williams has written extensively on this subject, and his textbook, Legal Negotiation and Settlement, published by West, has been adopted by over 100 law schools in the United States, United Kingdom, Germany, and Australia. Negotiation and Settlement in the 90s is one of many CLE programs available on audio and videotape produced by the CLE source, the Professional Education Group. A complete catalog of PEG offerings is available by calling 1-800-229-CLE1. We now present Negotiation and Settlement in the 90s.
Well, it's an honor to be here today. I should say that if I were looking for an audience who needs to learn about negotiation, a group of lawyers like yourself would be the last audience to seek out, because by all accounts, lawyers are the most effective and the most experienced negotiators of any group we could find anywhere in the world. Lawyers do more negotiating even than diplomats. So in a way, we are all inheritors of a proud tradition of several centuries of savvy about the negotiation process. And so I acknowledge that you come here with vast experience, and that it will be some challenge to add to the experience that you bring into the room. Now, let me mention that about 20 years ago this month, I happened to attend a seminar for young law teachers where Jim White at the University of Michigan said, "Do you realize that lawyers are not litigators? Even litigators are not litigators. They are negotiators. Because even litigators settle something like 90%+ of the cases that are filed in court. And so the primary occupation of lawyers is consulting with their client and negotiating with lawyers or the principal person on the other side of transactions and cases." The interesting thing was, law schools were teaching appellate practice and they were teaching trial practice, but they were not teaching negotiation, which is at the heart of the lawyering function. So I was just young and naive enough to think that maybe I could bite off this question of what is it that lawyers do when they negotiate? What makes effective lawyers so effective as negotiators? And I went back to the university where I was teaching, and I got three social science colleagues, and we applied for a large federal grant. To our amazement, we received the grant, and we undertook to study lawyers as negotiators over a three-year period. We began in Denver, Colorado, and the first thing we did was to gather a list from Denver lawyers of colleagues that they considered effective negotiators. And we compiled a list of 50 lawyers with reputations for excellence in negotiation. I wrote a letter to all 50 saying, "We're studying negotiation. Would you be willing to pick a case, whether a transaction or a dispute, pick a matter that was significant, that involved a lot of negotiation? And would you be willing to review the file, refresh yourself on the facts, think about the lawyer or the person on the other side you primarily negotiated against, and let us come interview you?" Well, 47 of the 50 lawyers said yes. So 47 times I went into a law office and I put the tape recorder on their desk and I said, "Well, did you pick a case or a transaction?" And they'd say, "Yep." I'd say, well, what were the facts?" And you know, lawyers are so verbal, and out would come all of these facts off the top of their head. I'd say, "Well, what were the issues?" And out would come a really fine statement of the issues in the case. "And what were the strengths and weaknesses on either side?" And we'd get a really fine statement of the evaluation of the case from both sides. And I'd have this sense almost of intoxication that this is pure gold. And then I would ask the crucial question. Now think of the lawyer or the non-lawyer on the other side that you primarily negotiated against. What was that person like as a negotiator? Well, time and again, I would get to that question, and these abundant fountains of words would just cut right off. And one after another, they'd kind of scratch their head and say, you know, when it comes to negotiation, you can't learn about that by talking about it. You can only learn that part by doing. So what were they saying? They were saying, forget your research. Go out and practice law, and at the end of your career, you'll know all this stuff. And that's literally true, isn't it? Because that's how all of you have learned what you know, that you learn that stuff by experience. But there's a catch, and the catch is this, that you won't be able to tell anyone else about it. Now, why is it that you all bring such rich experience into this room, and yet if I invited you up and say, tell us everything you know about negotiation, it would probably be disappointing? And we began to realize that the problem among lawyers is that we are inheritors of a rich tradition of know-how and insight and process about the negotiation phenomenon, but we have no set of shared concepts and no shared vocabulary by which we can communicate about it. So for the past 20 years, my primary research occupation has been to learn from you as practicing lawyers what the concepts are you use as you negotiate and what the vocabulary is that best communicates that very rich knowledge and understanding. So what I have to give to you today comes largely from work with experienced lawyers like yourselves, learning what you're doing, learning what the underlying concepts are, and developing a vocabulary by which we can share it among ourselves here. Now, I should also acknowledge that we live in a very interesting day. There have been a lot of studies of the attitudes of ingoing law students. And those studies show that all of us went to law school with a higher purpose in mind. We didn't just want a job. We wanted a vocation. We wanted a profession that would contribute to a larger good. Every study of exiting law students that has been made shows that we leave law school more cynical, less idealistic than we went in, but still with a glimmer of hope of serving some larger good and finding meaning in serving other people through our profession. And yet, we live in a day when lawyers are leaving the legal profession in record numbers, when they're finding they did not find the meaning they hoped to find when they went to law school. If your instinct is like mine, it is that negotiation is at the heart of this problem, and that if we're going to find meaning in the practice of law, it has to be through our understanding of the purposes and the processes of negotiation, and particularly the experience of clients whom we serve through that negotiation process. Now, we're going to be covering a lot of material today, and I'd like to briefly sketch out what the whole day will contain. And I'll begin by making four suggestions about how to get the most out of the time we have together today. And after making those suggestions, we'll look at what might be considered pre-negotiation. And we'll cover seven elements that most negotiators consider important to take into account before they sit down at the table to negotiate or pick up the telephone to negotiate or dictate the letter that by which they're negotiating. So we'll do seven elements of things good negotiators do before they negotiate. And then we'll confront the problem that negotiation really takes place in two basic situations that I've already mentioned. One of them is transactional, where you're assisting in the negotiation of some kind of business or real property transaction, where the end product is a contract that binds people together in some mutual enterprise or in purchase and sale of some good. Transactions are not as difficult to negotiate as disputes, as cases, as disputes that are in litigation or could well be filed in litigation. And so part of what we must do this morning is focus on conflicts, on cases that come up through litigation. And I'd like to cover several things about them. out of the millions of kinds of harms we each are subjected to day in and day out, what distinguishes those few that rise to the level of coming into the office and asking your attention to them? So how do these conflicts arise? What effect those conflicts have on the personal life of the individuals who are involved? How dangerous it is when clients are in a state of conflict. Then we'll face the fact that when two parties are in conflict, they cannot get out of conflict unless they are changed by the process. The only way out of conflict is through change. And so we'll look at our role as negotiators in bringing about that change in point of view, not only for our own client, but for the party on the other side. Now, after we've looked at conflicts and how they arise, we'll look at transactions and see that there's a similar process that we need to shepherd our client through when we're involved in helping them negotiate transactions. We'll look at the concepts and vocabulary for understanding lawyers as negotiators. We'll look at the individual negotiating styles and patterns of us as members of the bar. And we'll find there are two basic paths. One of them is cooperative. The other is aggressive. And we'll find that that is a very meaningful distinction in the way attorneys negotiate. What characterizes effective cooperative negotiators? What characterizes effective aggressive negotiators? And we'll learn to recognize and differentiate between them and deal with either type of opponent as we might negotiate against them. But we'll also see that those two are not the whole story. And to have a more powerful function in negotiation, we need larger concepts. And I'm going to suggest there is a role for lawyers as healers, a very important healing function. And there's a role for lawyers as warriors, where we have to do combat in a very, in quite a literal sense on behalf of our clients, and what those two roles entail. And we'll look at four psychological principles that apply to every negotiation. And we'll do it by, I'll ask you some hypotheticals and ask you to react to them, and we'll have some fun with those psychological principles. And then we'll get to the main feature of the day. And that is to look at some videotape examples of lawyers engaged in negotiation, and it will give us a chance to tie down all that we will have covered up until mid-afternoon today. And by working together from videotape of spontaneous negotiations by very effective lawyers, very prominent lawyers, we'll be able to gain the most ground together. And then toward the end of the day, I'll suggest a strategy called tit for tat, which is the recommended way for dealing with the most difficult kinds of opponents. Well, that's a brief overview of the day. Let us begin by making a few suggestions about how to get the most out of our time together. And may I ask you to turn to page 83 in the material? Because beginning on page 83, I have tried to outline the entire course that we will cover today. And my purpose was to reduce the burden on you of taking notes. But I need to contradict myself a bit, because my first request is, will you please take notes today? Now, why would I ask you to take notes? And the reason is this. Psychologists tell us, if you do not take notes today, then by this time tomorrow, you will have forgotten 80% of what you take in today. To have just 20% of principal tomorrow and no interest is not a very good return on the substantial investment of time and effort that you've made to be here today. On the other hand, psychologists say if you will jot down keywords, you know, you don't need to take a verbatim transcript. If you jot down keywords as we go, rather than forgetting 80% and retaining 20%, you can retain as much as 50%. And that's if you never look at your notes again. All you need to do is write them down. If you actually look at them later, you retain even more than that. So my suggestion is, will you jot down keywords as we go? That's the best way to improve what you get out of our time. My second suggestion is, if it's any good, will you make a commitment to teach it to someone else within the next 48 hours? If it's really good, tonight at dinner, take out these materials and say, have I got something for you? Now, why would you do it at dinner tonight? Well, partly because whoever you're eating with tonight is probably who you negotiate with more than anyone else in the world. That's a pretty good place to begin. And the reason you want to teach it is because if I teach it to you, then I am the master and you are the student. But if you teach it to someone else, you become the master. And if the materials are really good, you would want to master them. And so I would say, not only at dinner tonight, but back in the office on Monday, please don't copy and sell these materials, because if it really does capture the concepts and vocabulary that you have been using and that your colleagues use when you negotiate, surely you would want to share it with them so that you can communicate from now on much more richly about the negotiation process. So that's my second suggestion. My third suggestion takes more time, in the sense that it's something you could begin today and continue doing from now on if you really want to be known as a phenomenal negotiator. And that would be to keep a negotiation journal. And by negotiation journal, I mean just a three-ring binder that has 6 or 8 divider pages in it, so that you can have some sections to drop things into as you come upon them from day to day. And let me make some suggestions of the sections you might want to keep in your negotiation journal. My first suggestion would be your notes from today, because you need some way to organize your knowledge of negotiation. You'll have invested 6 hours in this method as a way of organizing, and it's probably as good as any. I would maybe even tear them out of this binder and put 3 hole punches in them and stick them in the beginning of your notebook as a way to organize your whole understanding of negotiation. The second section would be something very basic, like the legal rules and the procedural rules that apply uniquely to negotiation. You recognize in the rules of civil procedure that there are particular rules that apply to negotiation. The rules of evidence have particular rules that apply to negotiation. Substantive law, particularly contract law, governs the enforceability, both entering into and the enforcement of settlement agreements. And those that apply in particular to negotiation, as you come upon them from time to time in your practice, just drop them into this section of your notebook. Pretty soon you'll be the leading expert of the lawyers you know on the negotiation process. Now, it also suggests you need a section in there on case evaluation. How do you put a dollar value on case? And you all probably have files on that, but one way to organize them is to keep them all in a common place in your notebook, because the art of putting a dollar value on cases is obviously one of the trickiest things that one does in preparation for negotiation. Then I would say, you need a section that would be your response to, who was it, Socrates, that said, know thyself. It's a section about you, what you are like as a negotiator, because effective negotiation begins with self-understanding. And I would suggest you take a clean piece of paper, and at the top of the piece of paper, you write, as a negotiator, I am. And then beginning today, you try to answer that question, what you are like as a negotiator. And the more you understand your own patterns and your own assumptions and your own weaknesses possibly as a negotiator, the more satisfaction it is in negotiating and in developing areas that are weak into strength. Now, in addition to knowing thyself, I think you need to know your opponent. So there would be a B section that has to do with learning as much as you can about the lawyer or the non-lawyer, the principal person on the other side you're negotiating against. To keep book by asking questions of, you know, other people who know them, others who've negotiated against them, what the reputation is, what does it mean when they ask for $50,000 or $50 million. The meaning of what they do and how it turned out is very important so that you'll know what words mean when you deal with them. Then I would suppose today you have to have a section in your notebook on alternative dispute resolution. I know that Texas has been one of the leaders in the development of alternatives to litigation. And whether or not you see them as a good idea, they're just a reality in the everyday practice of law. And I think good negotiators are keeping track of the alternatives, mediation and arbitration and early neutral evaluation and what other methods there are, so that you can give good advice to your clients on whether and when to use them, and that you can adequately represent them when they might choose to use them. Then finally, and I suppose most important of all, would be a section that recognizes that to develop as a negotiator is a lifetime process. It's a lifelong process. Because the fundamental truth I've come to recognize after 20 years of work with lawyers and negotiation is this: that you can be no more as a negotiator than you are as a human being. And therefore, to develop as a negotiator is to develop as a person. And if we all lived in a little Grecian city-state of two or three centuries ago, 2,500 years ago, we would know each other as a small community, would have a common literature and a common theater, a common cultural heritage that would teach us what development into a whole person meant. But there is no common culture in the United States. We have such a rich variety of cultures that it's hard to talk together about what development means. There is, however, a common cultural touchstone, and that is the cinema. And so today I'm going to be making some suggestions of how or why to get a tax write-off on a good VCR and a membership in a good video club, and start seeing some movies that would really move you forward in your sense of what negotiation entails and what qualities of great negotiators are, and also maybe even renew your library card and dip into a couple of books. So maybe a section of movies you want to see and books you want to read. And I've got a list in the back of our material today to get you started on movies and on books. Well, that's the third suggestion. The last suggestion is what Elaine mentioned, and that is, will you be willing to pitch in with your questions and comments all day long? If you're willing, please ask them, raise your hand and ask them orally, but also in the very back of the materials, I think the last page is a page for written that invites written comments. Let's see here. I think it's page, just before page 112. There's a sheet there if you prefer to ask the question in writing and hand it to me during the break, and I'll try to address those questions as we come to our break periods or as you raise them as we go along. Okay, now against that introduction, let's begin with pre-negotiation. What are the things that good negotiators like to take into account before they actually begin negotiating? And that list begins at the bottom of page 83. And the first item any of you would tell me to put on the list is preparation. And there are a couple of things to say about preparation. Have you done like I have and attended a CLE seminar, say, on how to get a $15 million verdict? And it's taught by someone who just got a $15 million verdict. And you begin at 8:30 or 9 in the morning, and then they say, in order to get a $15 million verdict, this is what you got to do, and they start making lists of what you must do. And the day gets longer and longer and longer, and the list gets longer and longer and longer. And by mid-afternoon, what you have learned is this: that according to this speaker, you are not capable of handling a $15 million case. You know, so if you ever get a case that looks like it has that potential, you better refer it to me. You know, only I can do that. Now, that is not an honest use of the concept of preparation, because preparation among the best negotiators means ordinarily competent preparation. It is not superhuman. It is what each of you in this room is perfectly capable of doing, and it takes into account that there's never enough time and enough client resources to do everything you'd want to do. The most important point is this: if you don't feel prepared, don't negotiate. Because if you don't feel prepared and you negotiate, you will compensate by being too tough or too soft. And either way, you do worse for your client than if you say, I'm not ready, I'll get ready and call you back this afternoon. So if you don't feel ready, don't negotiate. Now, there are two different functions that preparation serves. One, of course, is to get you the information you need in order to competently negotiate on the client's behalf. So it's getting information to you. But there's another purpose in preparation, one that you'd rather not hear me talk about because this is harder. But the other purpose in preparation is to gradually bring your client around to a better understanding of their situation, to give them the benefit of some reality checks that would orient them better to what is possible in this case and to the realistic possibilities about an outcome. The finest lawyers today are much better at getting the information they need than they are at involving their clients in the preparation process. And yet, if we really want to serve our clients, we have to involve them in the preparation process so that they can be getting the reality check, so they can be getting a better perspective of where they stand and what might be possible. So my most important recommendation is involve your clients more in the preparation process. Now, the reason for that we'll see in a moment, but if you'll just kind of hold that in mind, and I'll give you a reference of the best single source of information on how to involve your clients more. We'll get to that in just a few minutes, but if you'll just recall that as we go along. Now, the second item, top of page 84, is evaluation. Now, our attitude towards evaluation reflects the common law assumption that comes to us out of the law of remedy. The common law of remedy is based on this simple assumption that every kind of harm to person or property can be made legally whole with money. So we are all trained to think of the solution to cases as money. Example, I'm a farmer and I'm burning the weeds in my ditch. I negligently let the fire get away and it burns down my neighbor's haystack. Well, the common law thinks about that problem like this, that the judge or the jury knows the number of dollars that will make my neighbor farmer legally whole. Or you drive your brand new sports car off the showroom floor and some idiot runs into the side of it and smashes it all up. The common law says that's not a problem because the adjuster knows the number of dollars that'll make you legally whole. It'll be as if you were never run into in the first place. Or I am insanely drunk, I cause a tragic accident, it cuts off both of your legs. The common law says that's not a problem. You find what legs are worth down here in Houston, and you multiply that by two, and that will make you legally whole. Well, you see, there's a problem with that assumption, because that assumption believes that the things we value most in life can be replaced with money. But as you know from your own experience, there is not enough money to replace the things that we value most. And so we are in the catch-22 that we tend to have to ask for money as compensations if we're plaintiffs, or we tend to have to pay some money if we're defendants. But the money is standing in for something that is to the plaintiff far more valuable that was lost. The problem with evaluation is that money is never enough. So to really be powerful in negotiation, the secret is to look behind the money and to invest yourself in learning the underlying interests and needs of the human beings involved. Invest yourself in learning the underlying interests and needs of the human beings involved, particularly of the persons who were hurt, the plaintiff, but also the underlying interests and needs of the defendant. And the more you learn them and address them, the more power you will have in negotiation. So that's the second aspect of evaluation, the underlying interests and needs.
This is the end of Tape 1, Side 1. Our program continues on Side 2.
Now, there's a third aspect, and that has to do with assessing the potential in this situation for joint gain. And basically, we are taught to think of cases as having no potential for joint gain. We think of them as having just one issue, and that's money in a lump sum as soon as you can get it, or if you're the plaintiff, or delaying having to pay it as long as you can, I suppose, if you're the defendant. But we tend to think of money in a lump sum. So long as we define the situation as having just one issue, and that is money, then there is no potential for joint gain. And part of the lawyer's art, craft, in negotiation is to find ways to define single-issue, money-based cases into multiple-issue cases. Because the moment you have multiple issues that include the underlying interest and need, it's possible to begin dovetailing the interests of the two sides in a way that adds more value to both of them than if you were just fighting over dollars. Now, our topic today is not to develop completely the idea of joint gain, but I'll be referring to it from point to point as we go. But let me right now say there is a, if you are interested in it, and I should think it would be an area you could quickly gain additional strength in by a little bit extra work, it would be to pick up this book referred to in the footnote at the bottom of the page, Roger Fisher and William Urey, Getting to Yes. Getting to Yes is a deceptively easy book to read, but it is the wisest and best explanation of how to capture joint gains in negotiation. And I highly recommend it to each one of you. If you only read one book as a result of today's work, I hope it will be Getting to Yes. Now, I have footnoted the first edition. There's a, in 1992, a second edition came out, and that's probably the better one to get, the second edition, 1992, of Getting to Yes. Now, we've talked about preparation, and one aspect of preparation, of course, is evaluation. Another aspect is determining your objective, deciding what you're trying to accomplish in this case. And our habit is to think in terms of dollar objective. And the idea behind this would be to say, yes, you must have dollar objectives, but in addition, invest yourself in deciding what your objectives are in terms of meeting the underlying interests and needs of the party, because that's where your power comes in negotiation. And in addition, what are your objectives with respect to joint gain? If there's a potential to dovetailing some interests here, then I would include those consciously as part of your objectives in negotiation. Now, notice that it's only after we get evaluation and objectives that we come to number four, which is strategy. And some people are surprised that it's only four because they think strategy, negotiation, they're the same thing. That those are synonyms, aren't they? Negotiation is strategy. Well, many books on negotiation assume that. And they assume that if they can describe a strategy, then any of us, like Dustin Hoffman or Meryl Streep, we are great actors and actresses, we could do it no matter how flamboyant or different from our personality it is. Well, psychologists tell us that just isn't true, that each of us, being human, tends to negotiate the same way every single time. And they say we have basically two modes of negotiation. We have regular and we have angry. and that's our repertory, you know, that's all we can do. And if that's kind of the human condition, then it's probably not as useful to think about strategy in terms of could I do what somebody in Winning Through Intimidation says they did one time. It would be better to be a bit more goal-oriented with strategy and say this. in the next half hour, what could I do that would move us closer to our dollar objectives in this case? Or I've got the afternoon available. What could I do this afternoon that would help us meet the underlying interests and needs of the parties? Or I've got some time to pay attention to the case today. What could I do to help us realize the joint gains that are possible in this case? So think of it in terms of what I can do right now to move towards particular objectives, and that's a more fruitful way, I think of strategy. Now, we have those four, which are fairly straightforward, and then we come to this little unpleasantness that we refer to as the client. This is tricky because it is a convention in negotiation, and I've been guilty of it up until this instant, and I'll be guilty of it most of the rest of the day, but it is a convention in negotiation to assume that negotiation means lawyer A negotiating against lawyer B. And it is so neat and tidy that it's kind of compelling. And for the first 2 years of that three-year research project that I mentioned that we began in 1973, my research team, myself included, assumed negotiation means lawyer A against lawyer B. We ended up beginning in Denver, as I mentioned, and we then went to Phoenix to do some follow-up work. In Phoenix, we tracked a large number of cases that were scheduled to go to trial immediately. You know, they're scheduled to go to trial within the next 2 or 3 weeks. And we tracked them until they either settled or went to trial. Most of them settled. And so we went and studied the lawyers in the cases that settled. We were studying negotiation and settlement. Just before we left Phoenix, one of the lawyers we were working with said, "What did you learn from the cases that went to trial?" Said, "Well, we didn't learn anything. They failed to settle." And he said, "Don't you think you could learn as much from a failure to settle as you can from a settlement?" So a little light went on, and we stayed longer, and we studied the cases that went to trial. And this is when our education began. One of the questions we asked for the cases that went to trial was this: why did it go to trial? Why couldn't you settle this case like all of those other cases that settled? And here is what we learned. In 53% of the cases going to trial, the reason it went to trial was not a failure of lawyer A and lawyer B to agree. Rather, it was a failure either of lawyer A to bring his or her client A prime along, or lawyer B to bring client B prime along. So that is a rather stunning statistic, that over half of the cases going to trial, the reason they went to trial was not because A and B were unable to frame out an agreement. They could frame it out, but one lawyer or the other was unable to bring his or her client along. So that tells me we have to think of negotiation as a war on two fronts. And the first front, and the obvious one, is me or you, if we're lawyer A, negotiating against the lawyer or the principal party on the other side. But that is only half of our task in negotiation. The other half is to turn around and face the second front, which is you or me as lawyer A negotiating with our own client A prime. And we have to invest at least as much time and effort and planning and strategy in relationship to our client as we do in relationship to the other side. Now, my recommendation to you, the kind of client you want to represent is a single individual with no family and no friends. So that, preferably no radio and no TV, so that it's just you who's helping influence the way the client perceives the case. The worst conceivable kind of client are the people you all represent who have family and friends who are giving them all kinds of crazy expectations. And worse yet, if it's some kind of a bureaucracy, whether it's a corporation or a partnership or a government agency, that not only is wide, but it's deep in terms of hierarchy, and yet it is part of your function to bring along the entire organization or the entire friend and family set of your client, if that is relevant. So we need to do today at least as much in understanding the lawyer to client dynamic when we are negotiating on their behalf. We have to do at least as much today to understand and become concrete about that relationship as we do about the lawyer to lawyer relationship in negotiation. And in this respect, the single most important thing we can do is involve our clients in the process of preparation. And I believe I have at the bottom of the footnote, bottom of page 85, it says the single best reference on methods and benefits of involving clients more actively in the negotiation process, which means mostly preparation, but also consultation throughout the negotiation process, is this book by Douglas Rosenthal, Lawyer and Client, Who's in Charge? And if you went to law school and were not able to have a course in interviewing and counseling, then I think the other thing you really would want to do to become superior in this respect would be to read one of the good books on interviewing and counseling. And one is Thomas Schaefer and James Elkins, Legal Interviewing and Counseling in a Nutshell. Now, that is really a fine short work on everything you'd want to know with respect to your relationship with your client when you're counseling them during the representation process. If you're a bit more ambitious, the classic work is the second one noted there. It's David Binder and Susan Price, Legal Interviewing and Counseling, A Client-Centered Approach. One or the other of those would really be well paid if you went through it, because we need to learn what the clients experience when they are being brought through this process towards agreement. Now, let's see, that was number five, the client. Number six, we should say just a word about the opposing lawyer. What I have learned, and mostly from lawyers who aren't very happy about it, is this: the more experienced and sophisticated you become as a negotiator, the more of your time you have to spend educating your opponent about the process. Not just about the case, but educating your opponent about the process. And in a few minutes, we'll be talking about stages of the negotiation process, and it's those in particular that you need to have patience with and educate your opponent, because you can't get to a really fine agreement except with an opponent who understands what the process is all about. So that is one principle, that the more you understand, the more you have to be patient and educate your opponent. But there are some other principles that are at work here. One of the ways I have learned most richly from lawyers about a negotiation process is sitting in a firm meeting or a meeting of a small group of lawyers when they are planning how to respond to a demand or offer letter from the other side. And you've all sat in those meetings where you're just trying to brainstorm, how should we respond? What did their letter mean, and how should we respond to it? And those discussions among lawyers on one side of the case are invariably stunning in their richness. I mean, the variations on what the other side's letter might mean, and the richness of the possibility of response and what you hope to convey back to them, is really startling to me. And I have sat in those discussions and felt so nourished. And then somebody drafts the reply letter, and I look at the reply letter, and do you know what it says? It says, we received your letter of the 17th. We reject what you had to say. We insist that you do the following, and if you don't do it by Friday, you're going to be in big trouble. And I say, wait a minute, where's all the richness of that discussion? All that stuff you wanted to tell them by this letter. They say, oh, we're not going to tell them directly. You know, they have to figure that out by reading between the lines. And the best, the money I have earned the most in the sense that I added the most value to lawyers is to say, wait a minute, don't mail this letter. Sit down and write out what you hope the other side will understand from this letter and send that to them. Because only by being very clear with what you hope the other side will understand, is there any possibility that they will actually understand it. And in my experience, part of the reason you don't want to spell it all out in the letter is because you're not sure what the other side's letter meant, because it didn't have very much in it either. So usually the first step would be to call up the other side and say, thank you, we got your letter, but I have just a couple of questions. And you ask them some questions to find out what they meant when they said those few things in the letter. So first you ask them enough questions that you understand what they meant. And then you very clearly spell out all of your own hopes and expectations and communicate that in writing to them. And you'll be astonished at how it moves things forward in the negotiation. So keep your eyes on the purpose of the process. Clearly say what you really mean, and call up your opponents and ask them what they meant, so you clearly understand what they really meant. Now, the last item in our list is, what about the opposing party? So if we're representing A prime, we've looked at dealing with lawyer B, how about client B prime? And of course, the frustration that we all face is that you usually cannot directly communicate with B prime. You can only communicate through the lawyer. And how many times, in what percent of cases, do you feel that B, lawyer B, is not adequately communicating this stuff back to the client? And isn't that almost universal? You think, why doesn't lawyer B communicate more with with client B prime? The interesting thing is, if you sent me over to talk to lawyer B, you know what lawyer B would tell me? They'd say, why doesn't the people you're working with, why doesn't lawyer A communicate more richly with his or her client A prime? And actually, it's usually true on both sides that neither side is active enough in working with their own client. And so one step to curing it is to adequately work with our own client. The other is to communicate richly enough to lawyer B that he or she is able to adequately consult with their client. Okay, that's an overview. It's a framework that you're well familiar with that we can refer to as we go during the day. Let us move now to look briefly at how conflicts arise, because this will be key to understanding what we should do to bring client A prime along, if that's our client. So how conflicts arise. And let me say that it is now becoming pretty clear that we all suffer day in and day out a fairly large number of harms and injustices and actionable wrong, that if we wanted to take the time and effort, we could pursue a legal remedy to. But as your own experience would tell you, all of us routinely just absorb those harms and we go on with our lives. For example, the Better Business Bureau, which handles more consumer complaints than any other organization in the United States, they did a study of how many consumers harmed actually do anything about the harm. They found for every 100 consumers who are harmed and have legal rights that they could pursue, of every 100 consumers harmed, only 3 of them do anything about it. Do as much as register a complaint. The American Medical Association has long been tantalized by this question: what would happen if we simply paid for the harm we actually do? You know, instead of resisting medical malpractice suits the way we do, what if we just paid for the harm we actually caused? The California Medical Association, a few years ago, commissioned a study of that to see if they should maybe just start paying for the harm they actually do. they found, their own study showed, that it would cost them many more times the amount they currently pay to pay for the harm they actually do than it does to defend against the few actions that are brought. The statistics are there's only about one malpractice action brought for every eight malpractices, for every eight actionable harms caused by doctors. That reminded me of my aunt, who lived in Brigham City, Utah, about 25 years ago, and she went in for a hysterectomy, and afterwards was not feeling any better. And she called the surgeon, and he said, "Well, you got to give yourself time to heal." And so she waited another week. So it was 2 weeks after the surgery, and she finally went in and said, "You know, doc, I'm no better than before the surgery." And he examined her, and he said, "Well, lady, you know, once your appendix is out, it can't give you any more trouble." And she said, "Doctor, I went in for a hysterectomy." And he had given her an appendectomy. He never said, "I'm sorry." He did say, "I'll give you a free appendectomy, or a free hysterectomy, but you'd already paid for the operation once." We're worried about the woman who went in for an appendectomy, because somebody got a hysterectomy that day who didn't want one, but no one thought of suing the doctor. I mean, we just, you know, it is clear by every study that we just tend to take our lumps and get on with our lives. So what is it that distinguishes the case that finally does end up on your desk from all of these harms that people routinely suffer? And the best study that has been done is a study led by a researcher by the name of William Felstener. William Felstener. And it's in 15 Law and Society Review, if you're interested in the site. Law and Society Review, page 631. And it's a 1981 study. 15 Law and Society Review, page 631, in 1981. Law and Society Review would be in any law school law library. And the name of the article is Naming, Blaming, Claiming. And that actually is describing the sequence by which disputes arise out of the large number, the millions of harms that are done each day in the United States. And so for that to arise to the level of a conflict or a dispute, the first thing that happens is the person injured has to name this as the thing that is causing their life to shut down. This is the thing they can't get past. And so it has become kind of an obstacle to their further getting on with their life. So they name this as the problem with their life. And then, of course, that does not yet make a conflict. And then the next step is they have to take the next step, and they have to assign blame to someone for that problem. You know, this is the thing that's holding up my life, and they are the ones that did it to me. And then for it to become rise to the level of a conflict, they need to make another step. And that is, they need to go to that person and make a claim. They say, "This is the problem. You did it to me. I demand that you do something about it." And there are no good statistics on this, but informally, it's thought that somewhere around 50% of such claims are responded to. "You're right. I'm sorry. I'll fix it in some way." And so there's satisfaction, and there still is no conflict. For there to be a conflict, once the claim is made, the person claimed against has to reject the claim. Say, "I didn't do it," or "I did it, but I'm not responsible for it," or whatever. But they need to reject it in some way. And this creates the crucial decision point, because even yet, we do not yet have a conflict. For there to be a conflict, after the claim is rejected, the person who is putting forth the claim has to make a decision whether to just drop it or go public. And it is only if they decide to go public with the claim does it then measure up to being a conflict. And going public generally means take it to a lawyer and ask the lawyer to pursue it. Now, there are other ways to pursue it, obviously, but that's the one we're most interested in. So it's the decision to go public that creates the claim. Now, once you are there, then they are in conflict because they've already made the claim, it was rejected, and now they're pursuing a remedy. So now you have conflict. And conflict, let me remind you, is a very dangerous place to be. I've made a list of the effects on a person of being in conflict. Conflicts are dangerous because they unleash intense emotion, not only around the loss that was suffered, but over the refusal of the other side to acknowledge and do anything about the loss. So intense emotion around the loss, and even more around the refusal of the other side to acknowledge and do anything about the loss. And so a person who is in that kind of conflict, their ordinary boundaries are dissolved. Their sense of separation and connection to other people are dissolved. Their judgment and perceptions are distorted. Their reactivity to normal events is heightened, so that they tend to overreact or sometimes underreact to compared to the way they would normally react to things. Their ability to attend to detail is lowered. Their capacity for rational thought often escapes them. And their personality feels fragmented. They feel like they're not even sure who they are, that they're not themselves while they're in conflict. So conflict is a very dangerous place. And when somebody is in conflict and they seek out a lawyer, then there are basically these choices for resolving it. Most conflicts are resolved through a process of negotiation. And as you all know, negotiation is hands down the most frequently used method of dispute resolution in the United States. And the statistics are of cases that are, once cases are filed, over 90% of cases that are filed are settled through negotiation. Now, if negotiation is not powerful enough, the next most powerful method would be mediation. Because mediation, as you all would recognize, a mediator is not a judge. A mediator has no power to render a decision. A mediator is simply a facilitator whose role is to help the two sides negotiate with one another more effectively. And so mediation is often called assisted negotiation. And it is very much to be recommended in a case where the other side doesn't understand the process or you have unusually difficult clients involved. Mediation is more powerful than negotiation. If mediation is not powerful enough, then the next process up would be adjudication. And as you all are aware, adjudication comes in two basic forms. The simpler, less formal mode of adjudication is called arbitration. An arbitrator, though, does function as a judge. And the two sides do present their cases to the arbitrator or the arbitration panel, but it's less formal. The rules of evidence don't strictly apply. The rules of procedure do not strictly apply. It's a less formal and sometimes a quicker and sometimes a less expensive and a less harrowing process. But it is a form of adjudication. And then, of course, the more formal method of adjudication is trial. So here's the sequence. Once you have the conflict, the person goes public with it, hires a lawyer, negotiation will settle most of them. If negotiation is not powerful enough, then there's mediation. If it's not powerful enough, then there's adjudication. If that's not powerful enough, then there's murder. Now, I say that not entirely in jest, because murder is a leading method of dispute resolution among human beings. Do you know, in the United States, over 90% of all murders are between members of the same family or close friends. Murder is the way many disputes are resolved. Even corporations are not exempt. A month doesn't go by, does it, these days, where we don't read of somebody who was dismissed as an employee or feels imposed upon by some organization who goes home and gets their AK-47 assault rifle and goes back and kills a bunch of people. I mean, it is very interesting how dangerous conflict is. And I've misrepresented it a bit. It isn't the sequence that comes up and can finally end with murder. Usually it is either or, isn't it? Either the person who wants to go public goes to a lawyer and invokes the legal system, or they get their AK-47 or their Saturday Night Special and they go and commit murder. Because in a very real sense, the effect of going to a lawyer is to put the client in a container, a vessel. The lawyer A and client A prime, the effect of going to a lawyer and retaining them is to put them in a container that holds them safe, contains all of these energies that now are operating wildly in their life. It contains and channels their energy in a way that they can productively process the conflict without going and committing a mayhem on somebody else. So the effect of the legal system and the lawyer-client relationship is to contain and hold safe people when they are in the most dangerous situation.
This is the end of Tape 1, Side 2. The program continues on Tape 2.